You are listening to the Venture Scale SaaS Operator, the podcast where we interview founders who are actually in the trenches. We talk about the transparent journey of how they built their SaaS companies, how they grow them, and what they would do differently if they would do it all over. Hey folks, with us today, Sagi, the founder and CEO of HR Signal. Super happy to have you on.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Awesome. Let's start with the most important thing. What is HR Signal and who is it for?
So HR Signal is an AI system that helps companies to retain and develop the careers of their employees. We essentially are a one-stop shop for a lot of problems that companies have in the HR domain. And we do so with leveraging a lot of data that we develop and chop and buy and create proprietary data sets in order to feed into algorithms that we develop to solve these problems. So it's in a nutshell. Obviously, we'll get into more details, but we are in the HR tech space with AI, essentially.
And then who's the typical customer? Is that like for big enterprises who have a ton of data or for tiny startups who have maybe one HR person that just needs help? Like, who's the buyer of that?
That's a good question. We're actually in a journey to discover that. And this journey includes a lot of trial and error. But from what we've learned, it could help companies that, as you said, are understaffed with HR and in need of lots of automation and more than automation, deep insights that come from data that they can just can't wrap their hands around just because they're short-staffed. But we also identified last year that a lot of big companies and enterprises, which are obviously our main goal, they have tons of data that is untapped, unused, and with enrichment that we have from our own proprietary data sets, we can leverage everything to create new processes that they don't have before. So we're trying to think of that as as an agnostic solution, agnostic product. In reality, we're going to know sales and marketing are going to lead us to the segment that we feel most comfortable with. But we've had customers that have 30 employees that use the system. We still have, and customers that are 3,600 that have used the platform for different needs. So we're still on that journey to find that good fit, but it's mostly agnostic from size to size.
I would love to double click on that because for everyone listening, you're a pre-seed company, meaning of course you can't know everything, otherwise you wouldn't be at the pre-seed stage. But how do you technically go about finding that right ICP? Do you feel like it's just like trial and error, or like are you using specific tactics to find out who the perfect fit is? Like, lead us through that a bit.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think it relates a lot to what happens in the market. So for instance, last year, we've had numerous sales campaigns in different channels that we keep developing. And we are constantly trying to evaluate what works best for us. Like as a small startup, we need to have, defined processes with an end date and a scope, and we need to reevaluate and change our course. So like we're doing with a product, for instance, with product feedback and everything related to product, we don't want to waste hours developing something that no one needs, right? So with ICP, it's basically the same. When we develop our channels like sell, direct and channel partnerships and commission-based sales, we go out and try and see from the data, that is available to us in sales processes, what's the best channel for us? What's the best conversion rates? All that stuff, and it leads us there because we, as a small startup, we can't waste a lot of time figuring that out. And what else can we do? We can guess that we can go after law firms, for instance. But if we don't start at the baseline, talking to customers from different, industries and understanding the problems, we're not going to find, some sort of a niche. And that's, I think, what we're trying to do. And we've had lots of lessons from last year regarding how to approach that sales process with a specific, you know, size of company or segment of the industry. And we're trying to apply them this year, hopefully in a better year of macroeconomics. But yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And then, so are you basically, I don't know, sending cold emails or like cold LinkedIn messages and just the, okay, like law firms convert at this rate. I know like steel companies at this, other startups at this rate, and just then that cut out whole industry. So like, how do you sharpen that right now? Like really, like how do you think about like basically taking the data in and then making the decision of, okay, we completely scrap this industry, or we completely scrap from like 1 to 20 employees or whatever.
So yeah, there are some pre-assumed, you know, issues where we try to aim for companies that are, you know, from a specific level. We, as I said, like when we had like design partners and initial customers, yeah, we had companies very small, but obviously we want to aim for to give the best value and the highest value, and we need to find that segment, you know, of customers. So we're doing multiple campaigns, and this is something that, you know, my co-founder Andrew is responsible for, is mastered multiple campaigns to try and measure all these rates and reply and opens at all these matrices. And we know, for instance, that if we have some sort of a segment of employee size that resonates better with specific messages that we have on an email campaign, for instance, or automated LinkedIn, you know, some sort of a vendor that does that, then we can hone in on some of these companies or family of companies or industry. But in reality, we have like strict guidelines, which are how do we prepare, you know, cold outbound lists, for instance, that is a result of ranges of the size of employees, like the number of employees, size of company. And we know that some industries almost irrelevant to us because the workforce inside the companies in those industries is mostly blue collar, for instance. And we have a lot of data on white collar roles and salary benchmarks and career paths. And this is generally speaking our market, right? But inside that, like white collar is like the, you know, the biggest umbrella you could say.
Yeah.
Everyone, you know, works in an office, but inside that we could define, for instance, companies that have high turnover roles, right? Because everything we're doing, you know, ties back to retention of employees and developing people's careers. So if you have high skill labor force, right, and something that it needs to concern, you know, executives of a company if some key employee leaves, and if you have many engineers of a specific type, for instance, that have they're high paid and high skill, then it's obviously very hard to try and, you know, get inside, you know, the DNA of these companies. We can try and see, say, tech sector and finance sector and banking and everything. Okay, so we know we've got like a white collar, you know, workforce. We've got, you know, high count of employees, usually in the thousands. And this is how we're, you know, experimenting. But direct sales and email campaigns is only one part of that. Like, we're working hard on business development and developing, you know, other avenues and channels, such as channel selling through consultancy firms, for instance, which could have some sort of an alignment with our messaging and can use our products, you know, to resell some of their services, sell more service consultancy hours. So we're doing all of that at the same time. There's no time to wait, you know, to see what channel works best. Like, they all need to work. So
definitely. Quick question, like, how big is the team right now?
So when I'm counting everyone working on, you know, product, we're about 10, you know, with technical advisors, hands-on, and people working part-time. Some of us are based in Tel Aviv, Israel, most of the R&D team. Some of us in Cleveland, and we have one co-founder in Florida right now. It's been like that for the past year or so, and we're looking to grow this year, grow a team.
If you need to hire the right developers and ship fast, then React Squad is for you. A boutique agency that specializes in React and only works with fast growth startups. Visit reactsquad.io to learn more.
Let's switch gears a bit and go back in time. How did you initially basically find the idea and then get the company off the ground and finally like raise the pre-seed? Because on paper, it always looks like super clean, but like in the trenches, it's like it looks very differently. So take us through that journey and story.
How long do we have?
As long as you want to. Okay. Keep going. No,
I'll give you the short version. So I would say beginning of 2020, I was still working in a venture-backed startup in Tel Aviv. I was a computer vision researcher doing something else, but still in the data field. And one of the ideas that I had before I left, you know, the company and COVID happened and everything, was to try and leverage, you know, massive amounts of data, mostly publicly available, because that was what I had like in my disposal, or I was trying to get a hold of to understand how I can use this data with the knowledge I have in data science, machine learning, to apply that for, you know, HR problems. And the first thing I thought about, this was like around the time that we started, you know, coming together as a group, like a founders, but we initially had like a proof of concept or something that was even pre-MVP. If you remember, and if the audience remembers, at the end of 2020, people seem to like recall that like COVID and like everything was locked down, but it was actually a boom hiring going on. And our initial guts was, well, if we can analyze data in massive amounts and predict when a person is likely to leave their job, for instance, we can sell that information to recruiters, and we could be, you know, the Swiss Army knife of recruiters, because back then, and still some companies are, just spamming LinkedIn inboxes, you know, to search for hires, right? So if you can tell them, here's a short list, you don't have to send 1,000 messages, here's like 100 people that might want to quit their jobs, this would be great. And we started digging into the problem more, and we started, you know, buying data, you know, improving our algorithm. And the end of 2020, we reached a point in time where we initially thought that the problem we were working on, like the algorithm, something's broken, essentially, because we predicted across the board, you know, across companies, across industries, huge amount of turnover. 30, 35, 40% turnover in companies. And at the beginning of 2021, when we decided to shift from hiring to retention, it was because the great resignation started. Basically, this was all true. People were leaving companies in 2021 in the US, the average rate of 30, 35% turnover per year, which means that a third of the workforce is turning over on average. You know, some companies had 50%, some companies, and it was like dissected by industries, but it was bad, right? And then we started looking into retention, and we found that this was a massive problem for companies. It's costly. It's evergreen in the way that it's always happening. It's always a concern, and it's always someone's KPI to make sure that retention is up and turnover is down. So we basically shifted just our mindset, and the technology was basically the same. And we built an MVP that was super ugly but super efficient. And we started working with customers, design partners, getting the first dollar, you know, in. That was very important to us to validate. And when we actually founded the company, we took a few months to work with these customers. And at the end of 2021, that was the time that we started raising, you know, our first pre-seed round.
And before that, did you do that part-time, like next to your job, you and your co-founders? Or
so I'd essentially left right before COVID really started, like in Israel. And my initial thought was, well, I'll just collect some unemployment for like a few months. And because of COVID, I ended up, you know, staying without work, but it enabled me to do what I'm doing right now for about 17 months. And when we started coming together as a group, founders, And as time progressed and we saw more traction and people believed in the idea and we had, you know, more people join us, you know, and then thinking this could work, then started the process of my co-founder. Some of them left CEO positions, some of them left, you know, company president positions. Obviously it took time. But I think by the time that we raised our first round, everyone were full time hands on this. And it took a while, but obviously it was worth it. So,
yeah. And you mentioned that you have a couple of co-founders. Like the question is, like, how many co-founders do you have, and like how does everybody know each other?
Okay, so that's a good story. We're four co-founders, and two of them, including myself, I'm from Israel, and two of them are from Cleveland area. And we were introduced by a family friend that I have. And we lived next door to each other. We grew up, you know, in the suburb of Tel Aviv, next to each other for years. And his family moved to the U.S. And when I had the ideation process, you know, began when COVID hit, right before that, I was in New York. And that friend lives in New York right now. And I met him and I, you know, presented everything to him. And he said, well, he was working in, you know, venture capital back then. He said, you know, you have to talk to my friends from back home who live next door to me right now, Aaron and Andrew. So this is how we connected. We came, you know, together as a group because of that friend. And we basically started at various levels of commitment, but in the same, you know, time, working on this idea, developing it, and reaching to a state where we create a bootstrap MVP that had, you know, paying customers before we raised our first round. It really helped. So
interesting. How do you manage like roles between four people? Because like, I think with two people, it's super easy because like most times it's like the tech guy and the business guy. So yep. Like between across like four people, how are responsibilities split apart?
So yeah, I mean, we right from start had pretty complementary skill sets. Me and Daniel, we came from a technical background and less managerial, and we certainly did not have any HR background, which is, you know, interesting. But we had a way of solving problems, you know, with data and coming up with processes to streamline a lot of things in the way of thinking. And the other part of the team, they come from marketing background, sales background, strong leadership background, you know, business. And also, by the way, like the cultural, you know, differences, so to speak, they really benefited us because we did not grow like an Israeli startup, you know, in the vacuum of Israel, and then moved in like the penetrating the U.S. market phase. We immediately, you know, our company is a U.S. company. We just have like an R&D subsidiary here in Israel, but the entire mindset of how to do business, we already had that, and I was learning. I'm still learning a lot from my, you know, co-founder. But they were leading businesses, and they were involved in HR processes, and you know, some of them have previously raised money and invested in startups. So we all had like the I'd say like the biggest alignment that we had is having that startup mentality, like, you know, working hard for like a goal that you don't know if you're going to hit, but you want to be, you know, the best at what you do. So I think we had that from the start. And I can say this, like people in when you're raising a round, for instance, at the beginning, you don't have anything. So the only way for like a VC to evaluate you or any angel investor to evaluate is asking about the team and whether you have complementary skill sets and those like, you know, kind of like textbook questions. And we obviously, you know, had those questions, you know, being asked, but we checked that box. But we had more than that. You know, we've had the work hard, never give up approach, you know, across all of us basically, and I think it enabled us, you know, to move forward rather quickly and solve a lot of problems and have a lot of pitfalls, you know, and deal with them. So
interesting. Switching gears again a tiny bit, you mentioned before that like the market conditions of today, I mean, it's like early 2024. we all hope that the VC market is going to pick up, not to like the crazy ZIRP times, but like at least that everybody can get like proper and enough funding. And but like, how are you planning to play the whole thing? Because I mean, a lot of people right now are planning to raise like a pre-seed or a seed, but then want to become profitable just to be like unkillable, basically. Others, especially in the AI boom, just say, screw that. We still have a ton of VC interest. We basically can burn as much as we want to because, hey, we have the AI hype word, basically.
Yeah.
So which, and to be frank, both are super legit if you play them right. So which way are you going right now?
So we're actually raising our second round right now. We're after the process. I don't want to jinx it, but it's in final stages, I'll call it, that it's going to be a venture-led round, like our previous round. But in 2023, you know, we thought at the beginning when we launched our product on TechCrunch in March, we said, whoa, this year is going to be, you know, the best year ever. And this is the best time to launch a product. And we found that was the worst time to launch a product. And the entire climate has changed, you know, in front of our eyes. So obviously we went into a mode that is like, you know, we don't want to be left without, you know, resources at the end of this year. And we've used that year, you know, to prepare for, you know, a better time where like, you know, we had a long winter, we prepared for, you know, the summer metaphor. But we basically burned the resources that we had in learning a lot of things that we can now execute and implement that we had no way of probably learning if the market was like still favorable or up. So this is first thing I'll say. It's something that we used that, you know, period of time to learn and improve. But from a funding standpoint, obviously we waited or we wanted to wait for a favorable time. From our performance standpoint, from our, you know, existing investor standpoint, and from the market. And we, I don't know if you know, having the ability to complete that second round that we're raising right now is because of any of these things or, you know, the macro state of economics. I'm not going to, you know, say that I think that the market is up or something. But I will say this, you know, when you have resources, you need to look, you know, forward to your next funding milestone, for instance, to see what can you realistically achieve, you know, and try and get to that situation. Even if that is, you know, a 180, you know, different plan than what you had 3 months ago, because it's not only that the interest rate went up and, you know, investors were like fleeing, it was also a time where products were tougher to sell. Sell cycles are longer, and it's not because no one wants your product. It's because companies are tightening their budgets, and not everything innovative is now considered, you know, a must have. So, you know, alongside keeping your ear always open to what happens with, you know, fundraising, even if you have like 15 months of runway, 18 months of runway, whatever, you need to understand that situation and try and read, you know, the markets and improve your value proposition like constantly. That's like, it's not an advice. It's just something you have to work at all the time to stay alive. This is like our lesson. So
definitely. And I mean, so you're 10 people like all in right now. So I guess with the new fundraiser, we're like usually goes to like 2025 ish. So as like one of the two tech founders, how do you think about like building out the tech team? Do you like plan to like keep it like basically like do the segregation between like data and then the like regular product team? Like just like walk us through the thinking on how to build a proper tech team as a venture-backed startup.
Okay. So that's a good question. We're actually completing a plan, a roadmap plan for hiring and for, you know, if we need reassigning of roles and redefining, you know, people's positions in the tech department right now. And we're trying to think about how we can use the resources that we have at our disposal, which are our employees, our skills, and data that we buy, and advisors that, you know, or some of them are technical advisors, hands-on, and have, you know, a good insight into how to build a certain product, for instance. And of course, our runway of cash. And the process that we're undergoing right now, which, you know, might not be the classical way of building, you know, the tech team, for instance, but we're going from the product needs and the product roadmap and everything that we need to build and everything that we need to improve for current customers and people and customers that we are in, you know, a sales process with, and the, how we read the market, which is a big, you know, kind of like headline, but how we're going to read the market and create things that don't exist in platform today, that are going to address problems that we know are going to be the hottest problems in 2024. Now, we can only do that because we already have a platform, we already have a team, we already have data. 2 years ago, we have kind of like half guessed, half for sure what's going to be like the best, you know, value proposition, what's going to lead in our marketing campaigns. But we're distilling the needs of the product, and then we're creating, you know, our roadmap for R&D. And then we're making decisions. Okay, we have in the next, you know, 8 to 12 months, we're probably going to need like a huge sprint of AI, you know, processes and AI testing and everything related to algorithms. And this is how we're trying to characterize the next person to hire for that. And I assume then once the team grows, you know, and everyone, and we keep redefining people's roles, because, you know, having 5-6 people in the team working together, it's not like having 30 or 40. Then you kind of fall into the structure that is known. Maybe it works for a lot of companies, maybe not. But this is how we're planning to get through this period of time, at least, to scale up the team and use, you know, the resources in the best way. Not because in the past we didn't do that, but because now we have an opportunity to use, you know, and resources and information and the insights that we have about the market, how to, you know, like design partners are saying, you know, this will be the next thing for us. We need that to generate more, you know, revenue, for instance, and channel partners, example. So this is how we're going to plan on doing that. And it's going to come need-based, I would say, yeah. Not just like blindly hiring.
I think that makes a ton of sense. I mean, my day job is basically running an agency, and we work, for example, right now with like one like a legal tech founder who's a lawyer who's like now starting a company. And there's like, you would never approach an agency project where you basically are building a startup with like, let's just grab two engineers and build whatever. But it's always, hey, what are we trying to achieve? And what's like the minimal resources you need to get there, basically.
Yeah.
So I think it's super smart, because I saw it too often that people are like, I think people usually hire like two front-end guys, two back-end guys. Let's just do the same, basically.
Yeah, it's not always. And like, hiring takes time. And if you want, especially in like, you know, tech hiring, if you want to get the right person, you also need to, you know, to contemplate, again, the mindset and the startup mentality, because you're not hiring for a, you know, 2,000 employee company.
Yeah.
And that's something that takes, you know, a lot of time to find, that everything needs to be like spot on. There's no time, you know, to hire and fire. So
definitely. I would add one very specific hiring question. How do you approach hiring an AI developer? Because I see a lot of, let's just say regular developers. What I mean by that, people who don't have like a PhD in math and like a very deep statistics background, but people who just say, hey, I'm able to use the OpenAI API. So you of course like have the data background, but that, like, how should a person who's maybe hasn't that data background, how should they think about hiring an AI developer, even though that broad is like super, that term is like way too broad, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, coming from the field, I guess, not from natural language per se, but, you know, having built this company based on data and data science, I think that the answer is almost similar to the previous answer. You need to know your need exactly, because the world of AI, I'm going to air quote AI, is it in terms of like new jobs that are introduced, you know, into the cycles, that's very fragmented. And the ability to know exactly what a person does just by looking at their, you know, job title is very difficult when you're looking at something general as AI or machine learning right now. So that wasn't the case until like 2 or 3 years ago, before large language models were a thing that are now improving our lives, but making some of people's lives much harder. And we, as a company that, you know, uses algorithms and develops like machine learning algorithms to solve, you know, HR problems, in taking, you know, huge amount of data and instructing and training, you know, a model to spit out, you know, insights, we have adopted, you know, the entire, you know, text-based model world. And we're using it right now to create more new features that are very text-heavy and to replace lots of, you know, tasks that are being done manually by people today, not necessarily the best way. But when we're going to try and hire, you know, someone for an AI role, for instance, we're not just going to consider the fact that they know how to use, you know, LLMs or ChatGPT, right? Because there's more to it. Like the entire mindset of someone developing an AI, you know, feature or product needs to be similar to what, you know, we had before we had, you know, ChatGPT, in terms of, so you need to know how to evaluate, and you need to be like a free thinker in terms of, well, now it's not just like one input. You've got like prompts, so you need to do experimentation. So you need to create frameworks for experimentations. So you can mess around with ChatGPT. You can even, you know, use an API and build that, but you need to have some sort of knowledge or you know, that was, you know, you study that or you train. It doesn't matter if it's like a PhD or not. I'm not going into the actual definition, but your actual experience need to be, how do I take data and get the best result in an iterative process? Because, you know, you constantly need to train models. You constantly need to put more data in. So you need to know to some degree what effect the input would have on the output. And for that, you need to have, you know, the knowledge of a data scientist, essentially. Even if you didn't, you know, play with large models of language yet, that's something that we would be looking for sure. So,
yeah, makes a ton of sense. Then, because we're coming close to time, as a final question, where can people find you and the company online? Either potential employees that like want to jump on the train, or companies that want to improve their HR.
So we are in hrsignal.com, obviously, and we're very active on LinkedIn. You can find us at hrsignal. We have a cool purple logo, like all the HR world loves. And we post a lot of things that tie back to the abilities of our AI system, and a lot of things that are just workforce, macro, economic, you know, that are important for trends, that all of them obviously like influence, you know, everyday lives, and not just like workforce specifically. But we try and keep, you know, our content fresh. And whenever there's new features or new output from features that we have, like trend reports that we post, it's always on LinkedIn. So I'd say we're very active there.
Perfect. And we will, as always, make sure to link everything up below properly. Sagi, thanks a ton for coming on today.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you like this episode, then you'll love the SaaS Operator, a weekly newsletter brought to you by Earlynode, with actionable insights from SaaS experts in the industry, delivered right to your inbox every Tuesday for free. Visit earlynode.com to subscribe.